This is Book Public from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. On today's episode, I speak with Lori Herzl about her memoir, Ghosts of 4th Street, My Family, A Death, and the Hills of Duluth. Lori Herzl was the 7th child out of 10 children. Growing up in Duluth, Minnesota, she was too young to hang out with the big siblings and didn't quite fit in with the 3 little kids. So she kept to herself, a wandering, watchful child. Her father was a college professor. Her mother raised the 10 children. They were not the warmest parents and weren't very communicative. In some instances, the chronic angers of the house were too much and meant the children were always steeped in silence or in secrets. When Lori's brother Bobby dies in an accident, the silences grow deeper and darker. Lori was only 9 years old. The family never talked about his death. Those gaps in communication seemed to swallow everything up, ingesting the family into an even darker dimension of grief. This was an earlier era, the 1960s and 70s. Life had to go on in some way in Duluth. There was still school and snow and extended family and holidays. Life simmered on. But the loss of her brother and its aftermath affected Lori. The fraught environment she grew up in, where her parents' behavior could be unpredictable, became something to fear, or at least to hide from in the small nooks of a crowded house. Lori Herzl remains observant. Her favorite pastime is reading. She became a journalist, someone who wanted to turn the light on the truth. As a memoirist trying to tell the story of her childhood, that option was not always met with understanding from members of her family. But as her inspiration was always the truth and the story of a brother she wanted to remember, another option was writing this memoir. I spoke to Lori Herzl about her book, The Ghosts of 4th Street. Tell us about the book and just set the table for us. Tell us about Ghosts of 4th Street.
Yes, Ghosts of 4th Street is a memoir. It is set in Duluth, Minnesota in the mid-1960s when I was a child. And kind of the heart of the book and what the book leads up to is the accidental death of my oldest brother, who we called Bobby. His name was John Patrick. He was the oldest of 10 kids. I was number 7. I was 9 at the time. But the book is really about much more than that. It's about Duluth. It's about families, a big, complicated family. It's about ghosts. There are some actual ghosts in the book, or so my family would tell you. And it's about story. It's sort of a collection of family stories that actually tend to resonate with a lot of people, because I think a lot of big, complicated families have the same kind of stories, the stories that we tell that sort of define who we are as a family, and the stories that we kids told each other to kind of stay safe when things were not going well in the family home. And then it's about reading as well, the stories that I read as a child. I was an avid reader. You know, it was a house full of people. And I would try to seek out places, you know, in the basement, or sometimes I would take over the bathroom, which was, you know, not really something that people liked, because we only had one bathroom for 12 people, but any place where I could go and kind of hide and read. So it's also about reading.
Oh, there's so much I want to ask you about all of these okay. things that you've mentioned. Now, in the book, you call your parents by their name, by their nickname, Trish mm-hmm. and Gov. Can you tell us about them? I was trying to figure out, there are many beating hearts in this story, in this incredible book, but I want to start with your folks. I wonder if you can tell us about them.
Yes. You know, it's funny because a friend of mine read the book early on and she said, oh God, your dad was so horrible. Really, he was not. My parents were kind of overwhelmed. They were very young when they got married. I think my mother was 19 and my father, I think, was 21. He was just back from World War II. They got married. My father was Catholic and they started having babies. I mean, right away. He was in college trying to work on his degree. My mother had been in college. She had to drop out and they had baby. They had 5 babies in 5 years. And then the next 5 of us were spaced out a little bit more reasonably, but still it was an awful lot of kids. And They didn't have much money. They didn't really know what they were doing, I have to say. Neither one of them had come from, great homes. And so they really didn't have any role models. And then when they moved up to Duluth, their families were in Missouri, so they were far away from family. They had no help. So my father, I think, tried to control everyone as a way of sort of, making the family work. And he had a lot of rules and he had a temper. My mother kind of, I wouldn't say she gave up, but she was sort of the opposite. She was much more passive and not very affectionate. She kind of withdrew as much as she possibly could. She had never wanted kids, and here she was with 10. So, it was not breeding ground for happiness. It was a difficult childhood. Not a lot of money, and a lot of arguing.
I'm interested in this idea about your friend saying that your dad was horrible and you saying, no, he wasn't, and sort of allowing for the fact that this was a very particular kind of situation he was in and maybe doing the best that he could under the circumstances. I'm trying to figure out what the grace is that you're giving over to him.
Well, because my father was an English professor and he was a writer. And of all the kids, I was probably the most avid reader. And I also started writing at a very early age. So we had that connection. I'm not sure he had a great connection with some of the other kids who would probably not give him that kind of grace, because he was not, perhaps not as good to them as he was to me. I also, in the book, I'm 9. And so it's told from the point of view of a child. And I loved my parents. I didn't really know that there were other ways to grow up. And I spend a big part of the book kind of trying to follow my mother around the house and trying to get her alone. But she wasn't really interested in being close to her children. She had a lot of work to do. She had a lot of cooking to do. And we were kind of left to our own devices. But my father, he bought us books. He kind of instilled in us a love of reading, a love of art. And then later in life, when he started traveling, he and my mother started traveling, he also kind of gave us this view of the world that, the world is a big place and you should explore it. I didn't feel that when I was a child, but he did have good qualities. But, he was very difficult. There's no doubt about that.
You mentioned the death of your brother, Bobby, John Patrick Bobby. I was thinking about how he was in a very fragile space himself in terms of the family and his relationship with your father. For me, I don't know if it makes this loss and his death even more poignant somehow.
Bobby was the oldest, and so he had a lot of expectations placed on him. I should say that my father and my father's mother loved to argue. They would argue whenever they got together, and they both kind of relished it. Bobby did not like to argue. And so when my father would turn to him and criticize him or yell at him or try to argue with him, Bobby would just stand there and listen. I won't even say he took it, because he wasn't defeated. He just, that was not something he wanted to do. And that would make my father even angrier. And so they had some pretty difficult encounters when Bobby was in high school. He didn't want to follow the rules. He liked to wander the streets at night and then come back and write poetry. He was not interested in his studies. He had no plans for college. And, my father was like the first in his family to go to college. And, here he was a professor, and he really expected all of us to kind of follow in his footsteps. So yes, their relationship was really fraught. And after Bobby died, I think it was, anytime you lose a child, it's going to be devastating. But I think there was also a lot of guilt there because my parents did not treat him very well.
I want to talk about this idea of silence that you've also mentioned. Your family didn't really talk about Bobby after he died, but there were other silences, it seems to me, too. I don't know if some of them are sort of secrets, too. I'm not sure that they're all secrets, but there are silences and omissions and these kinds of things that people just didn't bring up, didn't raise, didn't try to talk about, didn't try to parse. Can you talk about how this affected you?
It's a really interesting question, because my father was a writer and he also liked to tell stories about growing up and what it was like for him as a child in the Great Depression, when his father had absolutely no money. He was thrown out of work You know, they barely got by. And he thought it was very important that we understood this and saw where he had come from. So he talked a lot about that. And there are a lot of these stories in the book. But there were other things that we simply did not talk about. I can't say all of us never talked about Bobby, because there are a lot of us, and I don't know who other people were talking to in the family, but essentially my parents didn't talk about him after he died. They didn't talk about his death. We never discussed it as a family. They emptied out his room and put his belongings in the attic, and that was, you know, it was all shut away. My mother was sort of the opposite of my father, and I think part of that was intentional. She didn't like his family. They didn't get along. And his family was very loquacious. They were very argumentative. My grandmother was, you know, 100% Irish, and she was, you know, very verbal. And my mother, I think she was the opposite. She didn't talk a lot. She didn't talk a lot to me. She didn't talk, you know, confide in most of her children. She was very restrained, and she was private to the point of almost secretive. And I remember my father and I talking about this late in life when he was, you know, just a year or so from death. And he really admired that. He thought that showed strength in her, whereas he just wanted to talk, you know, all the time about all kinds of things, but never anything terribly important. We didn't talk about emotions. The only emotion that really was exhibited in that household was anger. The softer ones were sort of scorned. So it was a strange way to grow up, with one parent who, you know, told stories and then another parent who told no stories at all.
You know, I was thinking about how, besides silence, there are so many other things that affect the mood and the atmosphere. This world that you create for us in Duluth, it's a very particular place, a very mm-hmm. particular space and time. Yeah. And you really put us there. You really bring us into those spaces with you as a little girl, with your extended family, your aunts. And I mean, I keep thinking about, you know, where's Laurie Herzl's next book about the aunts? Like some of these other figures that I kind of fell in love with for many different reasons, right? Even if we just get glimmers of them. I don't know what I'm asking you here, except that, I don't know, how do you feel about bringing this space to us? I mean, part of it is the mood, the world that you create for us to enter, where it's, yes, there were silences. Yes, there was anger. There was a kind of a chronic anger mm-hmm. that you had to live with as a little girl. But then you sort of look into that atmosphere, and it's really also kind of lovely in its way. It has its moments. And I think mm-hmm. for somebody like you, who was is a reader and was very pensive and wanting to write, and you had those sorts of affinities with your dad, it must have been, I don't know, maybe very fertile ground too for somebody like you as a little girl.
Well, I will say that the book really encompasses what was my entire world in those years, which was that house and the neighborhood around it. Because there were so many of us, and because we didn't have any money, we never went anywhere as a family. We never took trips. You know, sometimes we would go on picnics, and then all of the work, of course, would fall to my mother to make, you know, all the food for 12 people and put it in, you know, and haul it away. But primarily it was, you know, just the few blocks around that house. And there was, you know, the ravine that I went to, and the playground, and Old Main, which was the old part of the university that was not really used much anymore. And then my elementary school. And that was pretty much it. So that neighborhood is so vivid in my mind. Of course, I've been back, but what's vivid in my mind is what it was like then, not so much what it is like now. And so it was not really hard for me to recreate that. It's funny because I started writing about my brother's death, just that one part of my life, not the entire book, but just Bobby's death, the day he died. I started writing about that when I was in high school, because it was something that I felt like I needed to explore, and there was no other way to explore it. It wasn't something that I could go to either one of my parents with and say, tell me about the day he died. That would not have worked. They would have gotten very upset. And my older siblings, you know, even today, some of them will start crying if you talk about him. They knew him better than I did. It affected them in a different way than it affected me, because I was young. There were five kids between us. I observed everything that happened, but I probably didn't feel it. 9-year-olds don't have really developed emotions in that way, empathy. So I started writing about it when I was pretty young, and I wrote about it repeatedly throughout my adulthood. And I always felt very close to the child that I was back then. It was like she was at my side. I remember thoughts that I had. I remember how I responded to things. I remember watching and listening. I mean, it was not really that difficult to recreate that world because it just felt like I was so close to that girl of my childhood. And talking to other people, I'm always amazed when they don't remember their childhood that well. And of course, it's because I had this monumental thing happen to me, right? It sort of froze everything in my head. But since I have written the book and now that, it's been published, I don't think about that time very much anymore. And I don't really think about that little girl. It's like she's told her story now and she's moving on.
You know, I was thinking about how you must have been such a watchful little girl. And I was thinking about how in the book, there is almost this kind of journalistic objectivity in a way, like, but there's a restraint in the telling of from the 9-year-old's point of view that makes me feel emotional.
I watched, I hid. There was a and spied on people and got in a lot of trouble. There's a scene in the book when I'm following my father on his evening walk because I don't know where he went. He went every night. What was he doing? And I was very curious about what the other people in the house were up to because I wasn't really close to any of them. The older kids, they were just older kids that did their older kid things. And the younger ones were really tight because right after me, there were twins and then a little sister, and the three of them formed a bond very early on. And I was just kind of by myself in this house full of people. So I would hide under the table and watch what was going on. I would hide in the coat closet. I don't remember why my father got really angry when he found me in there. I'm not sure why. I mean, I guess he just didn't want me spying on people. I would go through my sister's things. I was kind of a snoop, really. I mean, it's like, what is, I just never really felt like I understood who else was in that house with me. I did grow up very observant and curious. And yeah, it was probably great training ground for being a reporter.
Well, can you tell me about the ghosts? Can you talk about ghosts a little bit?
Yes, there's a lot of different kinds of ghosts in this book, but the main ghosts, of course, were the ghosts in St. Joseph, Missouri, in my grandmother's house. When I was 2 and a half, I was born in Kentucky, and when I was 2 and a half, we moved from Kentucky back to St. Joe, where my parents had grown up, and we moved in with my grandmother and grandfather. But everyone else, she was so dominant; it was always just grandma. He was sort of extra. So there were 7 kids. My mother was pregnant with the twins. My grandparents lived there, and I think an aunt lived there. I mean, it was a very crowded house. It was not a huge house, just stuffed with people, but it was haunted. And there were a lot of different ghosts that lived in that house. And I don't remember being aware of them myself, but at least some of my siblings were. My aunt was, my mother was. There was one ghost in particular, the main ghost, who was, it was a man. And I think he was later somehow determined he was a military man. And I don't know if it was from the Civil War or from when, but he would come down from the second story. He'd walk through the front hallway. He'd go into the kitchen where my grandparents liked to play cards after dinner. And he would go down into the basement and go behind the furnace. And behind the furnace seemed to be where he lived. And the first time my grandfather experienced this, he grabbed a hammer and he slammed the basement door shut and he nailed it shut. But of course, that does not stop a ghost, does it? And later, he and the ghost became friends. And he claimed that the ghost gave him tips on the Daily Double. Now, I don't know if the tips ever panned out. I have no idea if my grandfather ever won anything on the Daily Double, but the ghost would give him tips. So that's kind of the ghost in the title. But the ghosts are also, these stories. I mean, the book is full of these different stories of people who are no longer with us. My great aunt, who was kind of a kleptomaniac, and she would go into the grocery store and open up her pocketbook, which is what they called their purses, and fill it with green beans and snap it shut and walk out again. And, somebody else in the family would have to go behind and pay the bill. But it's the ghosts of the memories too. My brother who's gone, Both of my parents are gone. There's some estrangement between some of the kids. I mean, that's a kind of ghost as well. So it's, you know, I think the fun ghosts are the ghosts in my grandparents' house. But I think the whole book is rather haunted, to be honest.
I want to ask you a little bit about some of the challenges that you face with bringing the story out, for example, with your mom. And you've written about this, and this seems to be the issue for a lot of memoirists, a lot of nonfiction writers. Can you talk about that? Can you talk about how you've just managed it for yourself and knowing that more and more people will be reading this book and learning more and more about your family? What can you tell me about that?
Memoir is tricky in that way. And it is, you do have to sort of find peace with it. And I wrote a piece for the Brevity blog that ran not too long ago. And I talk in there about how when I was in grad school, getting my MFA, one of my instructors, Susanna Lessard, told me, you know, if you're writing memoir, you have to be prepared for the fallout, because she wrote a brilliant memoir about her family, and a big chunk of her family just absolutely stopped speaking to her for decades. And that is a possibility. And in my case, that has happened with some of my family, not all of my family. There is a sense that these stories should not be told. And we kind of grew up with that same attitude, you know, and I think that imprinted on people that family matters should not leave the house. You know, after my brother died and my father was drinking a lot, you know, we were never to talk about that with anybody, right? And we couldn't have friends over to the house and that sort of thing. So I think that imprinted on some of my siblings more than it did on me, perhaps because I'm a journalist. But there was a lot of pushback when I started working on this, and I did not publish it for a long time. I did publish the chapter about my brother's death, and someone showed it to my mother, and she never spoke to me again. She was pretty old by then. And to be honest, I don't know if she would have made that decision if she'd been in her early 80s or so, but she was in her 90s by then. And she just wanted nothing more to do with me. She wrote me out of her will. She wouldn't let me come visit, even though I just lived 10 minutes away. And that was it. And that was hard. You know, I thought a lot about Susanna Lessard and what she said. You do have to be prepared, because you don't know how people are going to take it. And I made a lot of compromises. You know, there aren't any photos in the book. I changed the names of my siblings so that they wouldn't show up on Google, you know, if somebody was Googling the book. You know, I tried to only tell the story that needed to be told and not divulge anything else that might be painful or they might not want shared. But, you know, to be honest, they didn't want any of it shared. So you have to make a decision between, you know, moving forward with your art or your writing, or, you know, abandoning it because other people might get mad at you.
I know you know this idea about how the more specific a detail is in a work of nonfiction, the more universally appreciated it can be.
Right.
So I think for anybody reading this book who maybe didn't come from a large family, didn't have all of these issues that you bring into the story for us, there's still, I'm not going to boil it down to family dysfunction, because that's that's too easy. But as I've been carrying this book around and rereading it, the thing that haunts me is what you're able to make so resonant for us by just telling your story. We've all been 9 years old. Mm-hmm. The wonder, the awe. There's even there's a brand of magic in your childhood that we're able to perceive in this very particular house, in this very particular space, in this very particular time. It is still a beautiful, poignant story. There's a lot in here about survival. There's a lot in here about resilience and strength in the face of a kind of trauma. Mm-hmm. So all of this to just come to the question is, what do you want? I'm sure there are many things, but what's one thing you would want other readers, maybe others sort of trapped in the sorrows of childhood themselves or not, to take away from this book? What is it that you have sacrificed so much to tell this story? What do you want readers ultimately to come away with?
Thank you for that question. I think there are two things. The first one was I did not want my brother to be forgotten. And in my original manuscript, I quoted some of his poems in full. But as it turned out, I did not have the right to do that because my mother had disinherited me and the copyright went to her heirs. So I couldn't do that. And I feel bad about that because his poems were so beautiful and I wanted people to be able to read them. So at least there's a few lines in there that people can read. But also, if you read through to the end of the book, at the end of the book, there is laughter. That is how it ends. And that is, I think, the only time there's laughter in the book. And so really, to me, the message is you'll get through this and you'll find a way and things will get better. And certainly things did. And I did get through all of that. And I am okay.
Laurie Herzl, thank you so much for talking to me today about Ghosts of Fourth Street. I feel so honored to get to talk to you about this book.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much. And thank you for your very thoughtful questions.
Laurie Herzl is the author of The Ghosts of Fourth Street. It's published by the University of Minnesota Press. This has been Book Public from Texas Public Radio. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.